Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is mastering engineer Pete Dell. But first, we're going to talk about gaming Spotify. And what I mean by that is trying to up your Spotify counts. This is something that's been going on for quite a long time, actually. Not so much in Spotify, but it happens on every platform. First of all, it happened way back when with MySpace, where suddenly someone found a way to up their follower counts, so it looked like they had millions, when in fact it was more like hundreds. And then it happened with Facebook likes, where you can buy X amount of likes. You can buy 5,000, 10,000 at a time if you want. It happened with Twitter, where you can buy Twitter followers, same thing. You want to buy 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 Twitter followers, you can get them. It happened with YouTube, where if you want YouTube views, you can buy them as well. Well, a couple of enterprising individuals in a New York City band found a way to game Spotify. The band is called Ohm and Sport, and they're sort of a ambient band. And they found a way that they could up their Spotify counts by mostly playing their songs for 31 seconds. The reason why is at 30 seconds, Spotify counts that as an official stream, and you actually get paid for it at that point. Well, Ohm and Sport developed this app, and they call it Eternify, that plays a song for 31 seconds and will repeat it over and over and over again. Now, this is all well and good, but the problem was they actually got a little greedy about it, and they launched this app out into the world where basically anybody could call it up, could repeat a song over and over and over, and hopefully that artist would then get increased royalties as a result. The problem is that Spotify is always on the lookout, as are other networks, both streaming networks and social networks. They're always on the lookout for someone that's trying to game the system. And they found them immediately, and they shut it down. They basically shut down the connection between the app and Spotify. It turns out that really, you're not gaining that much, because someone did the calculations and found out that at 31 seconds per play, per stream, you can only get about 86,500 streams per month, which in the grand scheme of things isn't all that much. Now, if you want to increase your streams, it's pretty easy. You just take your album and put it on repeat and let it play forever and ever, and that will work. The other way is you could easily, with just about any computer with just the basic apps that come with it, you could automate this process so you can set up your own little app to keep on playing your songs over and over. But again, the real problem here is just doing it yourself isn't going to gain you enough to really make a killer royalty statement. You really need other people to do it, and you can get other people to do this. You can get friends and family, whatever, and up your royalty counts, but obviously it's not going to replace real streams, real plays. So Eternify was nice, a nice thought for a second. It's now gone. You can do this for yourself if you want, but it's probably not worth the effort. Best thing is go get those fans in the first place. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is uninterruptible power supplies, or UPSs. And the reason why I want to talk about this is I went on a search for a new uninterruptible power supply a week or so ago. And I found a lot of things out about them that I didn't know before. Why would you have one? Well, first of all, it's protection against losing data if you should have a brownout or a blackout. One of the things that's really bad in this day and age, especially in the summer when it's really hot and air conditioners are running all day long, you find that brownouts happen a lot and blackouts happen. And the real problem, if you have a blackout and you're running something that's important on your computer, like you're tracking or something, you can lose all that data with a sudden quit of the computer. And what the uninterruptible power supply does, it supplies a few minutes of power so you can properly turn everything off without losing anything. Now, sometimes people go out and they buy power conditioners, and a power conditioner really doesn't have that capability. All it does is it filters the power so it's a little bit cleaner. But if you should have a blackout, guess what? It's not going to protect your data. It's not going to protect your computer. It's not going to do anything that you need it to do. So forget about power conditioners. The only thing that you can get from a power conditioner is multiple outlets, but it's not going to really help you in the case of, again, a brownout or a blackout. What you really want is a UPS or uninterruptible power supply. It turns out that there's three different types of UPSs. The first is called standby, and standby only kicks in when there's a power outage. So basically, it just sits there on the sideline, and when you have a power outage, then the battery inside, and that's the big thing about UPSs, they all have a big battery inside that is charged while you're just in the normal everyday operation. Well, what happens? You get a blackout, power goes out, the battery kicks in, and guess what? You're saved. And again, you're not going to go for a long time with this. It's probably a few minutes, maybe 10 minutes at the most. And the bigger the battery and the more money you spend, the longer you can work. Well, one of the problems with a standby supply is the fact that there's a time lag between the time the power goes out and the time it kicks in. Most of the time, this time lag is very short and the computer won't notice it. But this may not be the case on some of them, especially the cheaper ones. So if you get a cheap standby UPS and all of a sudden the power goes out, it may take a little bit of time until it clicks in. By that time, your computer has shut down, in which case you may have lost some data. So that's the downside of it. The other downside is it doesn't handle brownouts very well. Now, a brownout is when the line voltage dips, it sags because of demands on the power system, on the power grid. As it sags, there is some equipment that can't properly handle a lower voltage. And when that happens, of course, you may actually have something shut down anyway, like a computer, because the voltage is lower than what it really needs. So one of the problems with the standby UPS is the fact that a brownout might be just as bad as a blackout. The other thing that happens is sometimes a brownout is temporary. It's temporary, goes back, temporary, goes back, and it fluctuates real fast. And standby UPSs don't deal very well with this because they'll kick in, kick out, kick in, kick out. And every time an alarm sounds, so it can kind of drive you crazy. So really, this isn't the way to go. The absolute best way to go is what's known as an online UPS. And this is the most expensive, it's the best, but it uses something called double conversion. Double conversion means that when you plug it into the power grid, plug it into the wall, the power goes into the battery, it's converted to DC, it charges the battery, and then it comes out of the battery directly, and it gets changed back to AC, and then it powers all of your gear. And the reason for that is you don't want any lag, and there is no lag. It can't feel a lag when you go to a brownout condition or a blackout condition. So in other words, the power goes away. As far as an online UPS is concerned, it doesn't care. So this is the best, but it's the most expensive. And most expensive meaning it's in the neighborhood of thousands of dollars. Maybe the best that's fairly inexpensive as well is what's known as a line interactive UPS. And with the line interactive UPS, it uses a special transformer that varies the voltage during a brownout. So basically, you don't feel it. It handles a brownout so well that it won't kick into the battery until the power actually goes away. And it does it fairly smoothly. So this is a really good compromise, and it's not that expensive. Where for a standby UPS, you might pay $50, $60 somewhere in there. For another $50, $60, somewhere starting around $100, you can get a line interactive UPS that will really protect your computers, will protect your power, will protect your studios. So every studio should have one of these. You should look into it, look into a UPS. But again, there's three types, the standby, the online, and the line interactive. I would recommend getting a line interactive one. They're not that expensive, and it's definitely worth the protection. My guest today is Pete Dell, who's a senior mastering engineer at Universal Music Mastering Studios in Los Angeles. Pete is unusual in that he had a long history of tracking and scoring and mixing before he went into mastering. He's worked with a wide variety of major stars, including R.E.M., Marilyn Manson, Celine Dion, Los Lobos, Brian McKnight, and Dwight Yoakam, among many, many others. I spoke with Pete at his studio, Universal Mastering. Pete, thanks for being with me. As always, this is always a pleasure.
My very great pleasure, Bob.
Tell me how you got started in the business. What, and I know you have a long history before you even got to mastering.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm curious about.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I used to work before I got into the mastering thing. I was a recording engineer for a long, long time. And when I first started at Capitol Records in the early 80s, I was there for about 15 years. The way their mastering program worked is, or their recording engineering program, I should say, the way that worked is you had to start in mastering. Last year, I read Jeff Emmerich's book, the guy who did all the Beatles recordings, and one of his first assignments at Abbey Road when he was a teenager was to learn mastering. Yeah. I think the concept there was like you have to learn what the finish line looks like before you're allowed to run the race. You know
what Ken Scott told me was at that point it was harder to get the signal onto a vinyl record than it was on tape.
Oh, absolutely.
So before they made you an engineer, that's where you had to stop. And even for Ken, he said he spent 2 years there.
Well, certainly it's a lot different today. You know, if we're just worried about delivering on a WAV file or even a CD, the physical limitations are all but insubstantial. But when you're recording to vinyl, it was definitely something you really had to know your P's and Q's about. And recording to tape, there are a lot of limitations, you know, about high frequency saturation and bias and plus the editing things.
So you started at Capitol?
Well, here in Los Angeles. Actually, when I went to college, I got a degree in electronic music composition, believe it or not.
Oh.
And I studied with guys like John Cage and Jaron Hiller.
That's the real deal.
Yeah, it's kind of a museum piece. I mean, I talk about electronic music to people today, and they think I'm talking about, you know, EDM.
Right. It's not the same thing at all.
No. In fact, the college I went to, we had the biggest Moog facility in the Western Hemisphere, probably. And
And
there were no keyboards attached.
Yeah.
We weren't trying to, you know, the switched on Bach when that thing came out. That even Bob Moog thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And we thought, well, what?
Yeah.
You know, you already have orchestras that do vertical harmonies. We don't want to go and repeat that. Come on.
That's so funny. I mean, that's the real purest electronic music.
Oh, yeah.
No keyboards.
Oh, yeah. Well, before that, we were doing it with PDP computers. We were doing it all. I mean, I'm going to reveal how kind of old I am, but the first compositions we do would be on punch cards, and you'd send it off to Princeton.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks later, you get a 7-inch reel of tape. That's your piece of music. You're hearing your music for the first time.
Wow.
Yeah. How stupid is that?
Wow. Yeah.
Talk about removed from the creative process. That's pretty far removed.
Well, when I was first in college, it was the same thing. My first computer courses were all in punch cards, and I hated it. I just hated the whole thing. So it took a long time for me to warm up to computer technology, thinking that it was, you know, back in the Stone Age there.
Right.
So, anyway, so you come to Los Angeles then, and you started at Capitol?
No. Actually, I had to, between graduating from college and getting into being a recording guy for, you know, as a career, you know, I've obviously got exposed to the technology of multi-track recording and everything. In fact, when I was in college, I was in bands, but I was in pre-med, and one of the guys in my band was in the electronic music program in the music building one day, and a door opens, and I see these multi-track Scully tape machines.
Huh.
This is like 1969.
Yeah.
Excuse me, what class do I have to get in to get in that room?
Yeah.
Because I already knew I already wanted to be making records. You know, I already had the gestalt that if you were a clever engineer or producer, someone who could control the medium, that you could make hit records, even with a less than great band, maybe even with a less than great song.
Yeah.
But, you know, you really, if you knew your way around the recording world, that you had, you know, something to offer here.
Yeah.
I was a big radio guy, radio listener, I loved all that stuff. So I took a left and jumped out of the pre-med thing and got deeply into the music program the last few years I was there. And then I became a professional musician as a like a performer. I played mostly bass. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Boston in the 70s, and I was a bass player by night and a recording engineer by day. Did that for
Where did you record it?
At a place called, which, believe it or not, has come back to life. It's called Dimension Sound Studios.
I remember it well. As a matter of fact, I recorded there. I spent a couple years in Boston myself.
No kidding.
Yeah.
What years were you there?
I was there 78, 79.
I was there till 1980.
Yeah, I left at 1980 and came out here.
Oh, me too. Didn't everybody?
I guess so, right?
That's the plan.
You know, this is why I like doing this, because you never really know somebody until you interview them. You find out all these quirks that you wouldn't otherwise.
That's funny.
Yeah, Dimension Sound is back to life.
The guys who owned it, both of whom passed away, I don't know, sometime in the early 80s. You know, and I'm going to guess that the building went into receivership and everything, and there's, I forget the guy's name, but I saw on Facebook, Dimension Sound Studio, I clicked on it, and it looks almost exactly the same.
No kidding.
It had that crow's nest kind of view down into the live room, and that black and white checkerboard linoleum floor, still the same. I think they built an extra ISO booth out in the front room where we had an office. But the control room still is in existence, but we had an audio designs console.
Audio design, I remember that.
And
right.
Some kind of homebrew MCI deck with Dave Hill's electronics.
I did...
not the Dave Hill of Crane song, by the way.
Right. I did a series of commercials there and a bunch of things for WGBH, I remember.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, small world. Okay, so then you came out here.
So I came out here, and I was, you know, equally torn about whether I was going to continue to be a bass player. You know, everybody has the wet dream of wanting to join a successful rock band with a deal, and, you know, I tried a little bit of that, and I think the closest thing I auditioned for that had any kind of success at that moment was... Weird Al Yankovic. Did a couple of things with him, but it was like, there's no money playing. It's a cover band. Come on.
Yeah.
He puts his lyrics on it, but it's musically not too challenging. So I suddenly found myself doing songwriting demos at a place called Wally Heider Recording, and I would be helping out Tim Boyle. I don't know if you know Tim Boyle.
I know who he is, yeah.
Yeah, and his wife was in a band... or had just left the band that I had just joined, and with these other cats, and I started helping him out in these songwriting demos, and then we hit it off, and he helped me get my first gig at Wally Heider's.
Wow.
I'd only been in town 6 months or something. So, you know, the die was cast.
Great place to...
Yeah, no kidding, because they were doing everything.
Yeah.
You know, they were doing TV, they were doing major film scores. The first record... that I got assigned to was an Eddie Money record, Tom Dowd's producing, and Andy Johns's engineer. I got to assist those guys. I mean, that's my first gig.
That's
not too shabby.
No kidding.
And it was a great place. They did remote recording, one of the first remotes I did. We recorded the USC marching band for Tusk. I mean, you know, I'd only been in town a couple months. Yeah, it was fun. Yeah.
So you work with King Kalei then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of, you know... a lot of great people there at Heider's. Great place to, and you know, people were dying on the vine, you know, because should I name who owned the place at the time?
Oh, Filmways?
Filmways was trying to buy it out from Wally Heider, and they were running in, well, actually they did own it, and they were trying to run it into the ground, so the, well, should I not name names?
Yeah, you can.
Sure. The Estrin boys, Bob Estrin and those guys were trying to, you know, make its stock go way low and then try to buy the company. And then Jana Feliciano, who was Jose's ex-wife, I guess when you're the spouse of a blind person, she had his power of attorney. She was his publisher, his manager, his producer, you know, everything. And she walked in with a suitcase full of cash and... snagged the company out from underneath him, the Estrins.
Wow.
And as a result of that, poor management on her part. The whole technical department, everybody scattered to the wind because checks were bouncing like every day, everywhere, right? So I got, because I had some background in the technical side, I got osmosed into the maintenance department, which actually paid money as opposed to being an assistant.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they were basically about to close the doors, and I got a call from Sunset Sound, actually the Sound Factory, which they had just recently bought,
yeah,
which was literally right next door.
Yeah.
So I went and worked there for a year as a tech, and I sometimes worked over at the mothership, if you will, Sunset Sound. And then I got a phone call to come to Capitol. That was like 83, and I worked there for over 15 years. And I started there, again, as a tech. You know, it's funny, I remember the interview with the studio manager at the time. You know, he said, well, you know, do you ever want to do any recording sessions? And I lied and said, you know, I really don't want to do that. And he said, well, we really like our techs to be able to do that. Oh, I'm sorry, you misunderstood what I meant. I really want to do sessions. And it was really only a couple of weeks after I started back in the shop that I was on sessions, like, all the time, doing tons of great records. And Capitol was and is a fantastic place,
yeah,
for not only good technical achievements, but also great musical talent. You know, you could stand in the hallway. They have three studios. You could stand in the hallway and, you know, it might be Diana Krall in one room, Stevie Wonder in another room, and J.J. Cale in another room, you know, yeah, or, yeah, you know, a major motion picture score going on in one room and, you know, Van Halen in the other room or, yeah, something. I, yeah, mean, they're, yeah, just hardly ever something that was like you'd not want to be on. There was just way too many choices. It, yeah, was a wonderful place.
How did you get into mastering then?
Well, I got lured away from Capitol, from some other guys who I had worked with at Capitol, and got lured over to Sony Pictures to do scoring. Because at that time, and this would be 99.
You were a scoring mixer.
I was a recordist and, yeah, mixer, yeah, and a bunch of stuff over there, but mostly the draw was that film score seemed like the last bastion of deep pockets and big budget,
yeah,
stuff. But it was right around the time when a lot of the film work, the music scoring, was being lured away out of town or even out of the country, you know, because orchestras, you know, whether it's in Seattle or it's in Prague or it's in London, those guys would work without reuse, without doubles, with all, you know, so it costs the motion picture production a ton less money on, yeah, the back end to do it out of town. And if they're using out-of-town orchestras, they're also using, you guess it, out-of-town engineering and out-of-town studios.
Yeah.
So the business that I thought was going to be just spectacularly fruitful financially wasn't. Plus, it was also very political compared to, you know, the record business. And I'm sure a lot of that was because it was so pressure-laden. You know, they're showing the trailer on TV that the movie you're working on is going to start in like 10 days. We haven't started recording the music yet.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Because, you know, you'll record it at the very, very end when all the reels, all the final edits are done, because it costs so much money. Could be $250,000 a day to have the band, you know, 100-piece orchestra, yeah, and the stage and the crew. And
there's,
it's expensive.
Nothing like standing in front of a big orchestra like that when, yeah, you hit the downbeat.
It's, oh, yeah,
like it.
It's great, especially with some of the guys in this town. Armin Steiner, to me, was like, he would play this game. Like, he would set up all the microphone pre's and the reverb sends and all the panning before a note was played, and just to make sure, and you'd swear that the first note you heard was perfect.
Wow.
Perfect, because he'd adjust the gain from experience too, but, yeah, also by the people talking underneath the microphones. And he wouldn't use the exact same microphones all the time. That's the thing that also blew my mind.
Wow.
But he was so great. And then he's not the only one, but he's just the first one that jumped to my mind, because he used to play a game with it. In fact, I remember one time he lived out in Palm Springs.
Yeah, yeah.
Had an apartment here in town. So, but this one time he was coming in from Palm Springs, and there was a jackknife big rig or something. He was stuck in traffic, and he phoned in. He literally phoned in the mic gain settings and the pans and the reverb settings while he was stuck in traffic. And again, the first note, perfect.
That's amazing.
It's unbelievable.
But there's 40 years of experience.
Yeah. Yeah. But like guys like them and him and Al Schmidt, Danny Wallen. I mean, there's a bunch of guys who are, you know, the elder statesmen for sure, but they've, you know, they've forgotten more than any of us will ever know.
Yeah, right.
Just well, fantastic.
Then mastering, how did that come about?
Well, like I say, I left Sony after 3.5-4 years, something like that, and I started being an independent for a little bit, and it was going pretty good, but I thought, gee, wouldn't it be nice to have somebody else pay the health insurance again?
Yeah.
You know? And an opportunity came up here at Universal, and what the opportunity was is they were threatening to open up like a Pro Tools mix room and do a lot of catalog stuff in 5.1.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can do that.
Yeah.
That could be fun. And then, you know, the reality of working for a big corporation, you know, somebody didn't sign on to the idea and the money was never allocated, so I had to look around for something else to do, and I got into mastering. And it was funny, the guy who was the boss at the time, his attitude was, you know, anybody who was a mixer would never make a good mastering engineer. So maybe that was kind of the gauntlet that was thrown that I decided that I would
like
to do.
What was your transition like then to get into mastering? Was there a different mindset, a different...
Yeah.
And how long did it take you to you felt comfortable?
Oh, easily, I would say a year.
Uh-huh.
I mean, plus there's... You know, I mean, there's listening for all these anomalies like digital ticks and snats and crap that, you know, as a recording engineer, when you're hearing it live, I mean, you can tell what a condenser mic that has lost its phantom power and it's starting to run away, or a tube that's starting to, or something's going into oscillation. You learn to hear and identify what those are, so you can stop getting a bad recording. But in mastering, you know, if a digital transfer, you know, and of course that's what we do all darn day, if there's a snat or a tick because of a clocking issue or, you know, we're recording to a big SAN and if momentarily, you know, the connectivity gets a little dodgy, you know, you might have artifacts of a digital nature that you have to learn to identify and know right away, wait a minute, I need to reboot, right now. Or whatever those things are. And also, I do miss, and it took a while to realize that you have to let go. You know, when I was a recording engineer, if you hear something that's ahead or behind or out of tune or, you know, you'd be able to do something about it, you know, in mastering. It's like, no, but as I'm sure you know, and probably a lot of your listeners would know, if you're using EQ, you can make something feel either edgy or relaxed. You can make it feel, you know, a number of different physical responses to the music by making certain energy, certain bands have more energy than others. And, you know, like if something has, you know, say a vocalist that's singing sharp, heaven help us, because that's way more uncomfortable than something singing flat.
Yeah.
That you could either help or hinder that performance by either emphasizing or de-emphasizing or bringing attention to something else a little bit with the energy. And so sometimes I sought refuge in the mastering because that's where you have some control again.
Well, the way you make
the music feel.
What's interesting, though, is the adjustments that you make are small.
Oh, yeah. We can't really change the balance.
Right.
But we can change the way you perceive the balance.
But that's what's so interesting about it. If you physically look at what you're doing, it looks like it's small, but it winds up, in terms of perception, it makes a big difference.
Absolutely.
And that's really difficult for people to understand about mastering, I think. That's one of the things, because they, you know, they think it's some major. And maybe in compression, you'll do that, but EQ... It's not like that. It's not like you're adding tons of EQ.
Well, you better not.
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah. Although there are people, especially nowadays, where a lot of folks, you know, mix in like home studios and what have you, that their monitoring environment is lying to them to some extent. Usually manifests itself in bass management. Either there's way too little bass or way too much bass as it comes in here.
Yeah.
And that's just because their monitoring is making you think you had the right amount when it was way wacky one way or the other.
Which is more difficult for you?
Well, it's easier to lop off excess bottom successfully and still have it sound musical than if it's something that's really bass shy. Because to add bass, like when I say bass here, I'm referring to like fullness, not just the bass instrument. Mm-hmm. If it's just the bass instrument, you know, if I'm starting to pile on bottom to bring out the notes of the bass or add something to support like the kick drum, or say, or if it's an orchestra, the low strings or whatever. If it's a vocal, you might end up now you're making the voice sound real muddy or tubby, depending on the key, and if it's a guy versus a female voice, you know, all those type of things.
Yeah.
Sometimes a cure is worse than the disease, as they say, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I find a lot of times, I find myself always doing the dynamic control if it's needed. It's not always needed, but do that first because that's going to change your tonal balance anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
To some modest degree. And if you get the right kind of color coming out of, you know, a compressor or a limiter early, then you have less to do. And it'll also, let's say you have a peaky voice or a shrill something or other, and you get something that adds richness and does the little bit of dynamic thing that you might find you want to have happen, then you have less EQ to do and less, you know, less disturbing.
But, you know, that kind of follows when you're tracking, too, where you always put the compressor first and then the EQ after, so you don't compress the frequencies that you're boosting. Or,
yeah.
You know?
No, but I remember, I can't remember who it was, but it was some legendary engineer that I got to understudy with at Capitol years ago, and he did it the exact opposite.
Really?
EQ first. Now, let's say I get a mix that has got, like, the bass is out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And in a situation like that, I may end up putting the EQ first to roll off the bass before it hits the compressor, because otherwise a poor compressor might be reacting to nothing but the bass.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of these things, like on a couple of these compressors I have here, they have a high pass the side chain, so you can just, you know, everything below 150 the detector doesn't see, so yeah, it's not reacting to like massive amounts of low end.
What's the most difficult thing for you to deal with when you get a project in?
People. No, I'm doing it. The check. Yeah. I would say the most, well, we talked about the bass management for instance. Now, most of the time I'm doing quote-unquote popular music. I don't do a lot like Eric does next door. He does a lot of stuff for Vrez Sereban, and he does a ton of movie scores. So I'm not talking about doing orchestral stuff, but for pop music, or, you know, anything with a traditional kind of rhythm section kind of deal, the bass management is it, and vocal level.
Mm.
Some people, you know, like it used to be, like if you're doing rock music, like who was I doing just the other day? I had remastered a bunch of Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yeah.
And in a setting like that, they always put the voice kind of far down, so you had to listen into the band to hear it.
Yeah.
But by today's standards, that's way too low.
Yeah.
Now it's practically, you know, right in your face. So if we're making a record that's supposed to sound contemporary, if you will, that you know, to have consistent vocal level on every song, that's a challenge.
Are you mostly in the analog or digital domain?
Almost all dig. I have a ATR half-inch two-track sitting right there, and I use that as a process.
You do, really?
All the time. I have it on an insert button, and I can turn down the feed to it so I can get the right amount of saturation or beef off the tape and make it up on the way back.
That's a good trick.
And it's a good thing. I mean, believe me, I mean, there are some good emulations of tape machines as plugins, you know, and they're really good to try out. But they really don't sound the same as that.
What's your favorite, what is a plug-in that you find you're using all the time?
Do I have to name names?
No.
I'll tell you this. The two brands, if you will, that I use are the UA and the Slate.
Yeah.
And really, it's when I say Slate, I mean all the stuff that Fabrice Gabriel has designed. And he has his own company, Iosis, and he has a ridiculously spectacular equalizer.
Oh,
as far as I know, that's the one and only product he makes on his own, Iosis.
Yeah. Huh. So
it's called the Air EQ. That's really amazing. And but UA makes a ton of great stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, my favorite too.
We used to have Waves on board here, but in the cheapness personification, we let the licenses expire. Yeah. I really wasn't going there very much anyway.
Yeah.
But I do love the UA stuff and the Slate stuff.
And in terms of how often do you get stuff in that's on tape anymore?
Oh, unless it's from the vault. I mean, unless it's some, remastering something from 30 years ago. I never have new clients bring a reel of tape in. Well, actually, I'm going to take that back. I just got a client, and the guy who's one of the principals in the company is a great mixer and did a bunch of stuff for Motown over the years. Ted Greenberg is his name.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his partner have a company, I think it's called Dangerous Analog. So they bring in half-inch masters of newly recorded stuff, and it's either jazz or like chamber orchestra, right?
Yeah.
It's an audiophile niche market thing, right? So they bring in analog tape. We master it all analog, can't touch anything digital, and we record back to analog tape, and they sell analog tape.
Really?
Yeah.
There's a market for that?
Quarter inch, 50 nips, CCIR, babe.
That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah. And it's so far, it's been really well received at a couple of these, high-end audio shows.
Yeah. What do they charge for that?
I think he charges $200 a reel.
Okay.
I mean, which is like a whole album, because at 15, you get 30 minutes, 33 minutes or whatever.
Wow. Who would have thought?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The romance of analog from me doing it went out the window pretty quick. What I mean? Aligning and biasing and leadering and everything because I have to record a half inch NAB backup and then 2/4 inch CCIR.
Yeah.
Masters.
Yeah, I know. I had the same experience a couple years ago. I did I produced and engineered a blues record, which is actually nominated for an award, so it came out pretty well. But the artist insisted on doing an analog tape. Went to their place with a 24-track tape, and I hated every moment of it, honestly, because now it did sound good, but honestly, it didn't sound that much better than just going directly to Pro Tools.
Right.
But it was one of those things where it's like, oh, band's doing great. Let's do one more take. Oh, it's a 4-minute song. We have 3 minutes and 50 seconds of tape. So you stop and you roll it back and you get another reel and you roll it on and everyone's cool off.
Then it's
time to do, let's do another vocal. Let's do another pass. No more tracks. And, I'm over it. the best I can say.
I do remember, and this is, I've been out of Capitol 16 years already. Ouch. But we were doing, I think it was Dinah Krall and Al Schmidt, and we had 9624 Pro Tools rig and the Studer 827 with whatever his favorite, probably Agfa 900 or something, whatever it was, and recorded the first thing to both of them, right?
Yeah.
And then did the playback, and then it was like, oh, we're going to do an edit. Well, we did it on the Pro Tools, and then we never rolled the analog again because it's just so easy.
Yeah,
right. Not only easy, it's just so much more creative, the editing part.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a spoiler.
Well, that brings up another question. So, when you get files into master, what's the resolution that you're seeing mostly? Is it 9624? Are you seeing mostly 48 okay?
I would say more often than not, it's 44-24.
Really?
Yeah. And to me, obviously, the bit depth is way more important than the sample rate. And Lord knows, there's plenty of great sounding recordings done at 44.
Yeah.
I don't find that a problem. I mean, I love it. You know, we do a lot of archival stuff, and we've recently changed our standard from 96-24 to 192-32. Don't you think you eat up a lot of space doing stuff like that?
Yeah, it's horsepower too, computer horsepower.
Oh, yeah.
But I did the tests 6-7 years ago.
Uh-huh.
We had three rigs set up, 48, 96, and 192. I got to say, 192 beat the crap out of everything.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was, we did acoustic sounds, acoustic piano, guitar, voice, keys rattling, you know, percussion, stuff like that. It was almost, is it live or is it Memrex?
Right.
You know, on the 192. It really changed my mind. But the fact of the matter is, especially back then, it was just too painful. You know, you couldn't get enough tracks.
Right.
First of all. And
yeah, I think at 192 Pro Tools, it's 16 tracks.
It's half the tracks, yeah. Everything halves for sure. So, but hopefully we'll get there, you know, soon enough.
Yeah.
But that. A lot of products that we have don't go 192 as well.
Tell me about it. I mean, of all the hardware I have in here, my 6000 stops at 96, L2 stops at 96, these Weiss things stop at 96.
So restoration, that's a big part of your job, right?
Well, there have been periods where it's a huge part, and right this moment it's not such a big thing. Although I did spend time over the last year and a half, believe it or not, on one 10 CD project of like Nat King Cole, and almost all the sources were from quarter inch analog tape from the 40s and 50s. Pretty amazing sounding stuff.
And did you have to bake it or anything?
No, the stuff you had to bake was Ampex tape from the 70s through the 90s.
I remember I was doing a 5-1 project for Cheap Trick.
Oh.
And I get this tape in, multi-track tape, 2-inch. I put it on the tape machine. It was Agfa. It was the red stuff.
Oh, the bubblegum stuff, yeah. Right.
And I hit rewind, and the tape exploded into a million pieces. Thankfully, it was a safety copy. But at that point, they pulled the job from me. I didn't get to do it, unfortunately.
Ouch.
So, you know.
Not your fault.
It wasn't my fault, no. But you know, that's kind of scary when you do that. And yeah, the last thing you expect is for something like that to happen. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
So you were sure then that everything was going to work, that you weren't going to have that same problem?
Oh, no, that wasn't. No, that old, 111 and, you know, those early formula Scotch things. And I think the latest was like the early 60s.
Wow.
And there was nothing. I mean, those things are pretty bulletproof.
Yeah.
No. And in fact, those acetate tapes, you know, if you have a horrible, terrible accident with the machine, the stuff breaks clean.
Oh.
Like the later formula stuff, the Mylar, it stretches.
Yeah, right.
So if it stretches and then breaks, you're hosed. You can't tape it back together.
Right, that's bad.
But the older stuff, the acetate, it breaks. Even though it looks like a regular, you just match it up and put a piece of splicing tape and you're good to go.
I want to talk for a minute about your gear. How do you decide on what gear you're going to use? Because for mastering guys, it's so personal, what works and what doesn't.
Sure. Well, I mean, okay, we said earlier, like a lot of people are mixing today, unfortunately, in more like a home studio environment. They're working in a DAW. I'm talking about people who mix.
Yeah.
And I'm not getting stuff as often that is mixed by a professional guy in a professional studio on a real large format analog console.
Yeah.
That doesn't come in the door so much anymore. So if you've got something that's mixed in the box and it sounds a little shrill or it sounds a little thin or, you know, then you immediately think, gee, it would be nice if this was rounder and richer, and so that means iron or tubes or, you know, some harmonic warmth that you can add. So almost just running stuff through the Sontek thing here. It's an equalizer that's been around since the 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
This particular model is much, much newer, but the design and the goodies inside of it are, there's plenty of iron, and it just passing signal through it adds beef and richness to a sound. Like I say, if it's wanting some of that, just to make it sound more musical, and in fact, it adds detail. The little bit of harmonic color or distortion is not a bad word. That it allows you to hear detail in a mix without adding an EQ or anything.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of harmonic color allows you to pick out stuff in the stereo field that was there is just suddenly revealed because there it is.
What are you using for that? Then the Sontek?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's one thing. I mean, sometimes this Manly Verimu compressor, which has both tubes and very good sounding transformers, sometimes I'll just pass the stuff through it for harmonic color.
Yeah.
And it really makes stuff sound more 3D, and you haven't done anything. I mean, it's not doing any limiting.
Oh, so you just have it at 1-to-1 or something?
Yeah, just unity gain, just passing through. I mean, it's probably doing something, but it's certainly doing something audible, and it's usually a very good something. Yeah. I have this other piece of gear that's analog that's really nice. It's a Rupert Neve. It's called a Master Bus Processor, and it has the ability to do compression just straight ahead, and then parallel compression where you can actually do something more aggressive and dial it in for a more modern thing if you want the drums to really spank, for example. Also has this other cool section. It's called the Sound Field Editor. We haven't talked about MS, but some of your listeners might want to know what that is. And that is, like, if you have stereo, you have the stuff that's common to both channels, and you guessed it, that will appear up the middle. Right? Mm-hmm. And the stuff that is not common to both channels, that's going to appear out on the side. So if you make a matrix where you want to process the in-phase stuff, the middle, if you will, that's the M of MS, I can either make all the information in the middle come forward or back, and on the sides, you can just collapse the thing or make it super wide without really changing the level of it, just where, how far in or out it sits, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Some of the other things I have, like in my Dangerous Master console here, I have MS on one only of the inserts. And then I usually will have something like an equalizer there. So let's say I have the situation where, okay, either the voice or the snare, say somebody that's in the center, is dull. But out on the sides, geez, the cymbals are out of control, or the guitars that will take your face off, or, you know, something dissimilar between the mid and the sides. I can, you know, EQ in an MS mode where I can, like, brighten up just the middle and it doesn't affect the sides, or I can add, you know, excitement on the sides and it doesn't, you know, you have a spitty vocal, for example.
Yeah.
You're not exacerbating the problem in the middle by solving a problem out of the sides. So that's a real powerful tool we use in mastering.
You use it a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there one thing that clients could do to make your job easier that you'd recommend?
Oh, there's, well, besides like the usual file naming stuff.
Right.
Yeah. One thing they could really do is not wait until they're supposed to deliver the thing in 36 hours that they send it to you for mastering. Don't paint yourselves into a corner. Give yourself a little time to live with the mastering, because, you know, I have my taste, you have yours.
Yeah.
And I mean, the reason you go to a professional in this case anyways, you want us to help take the project across the finish line in the best light possible. So we're a team, you know.
Yeah.
You're buying the expertise of the guy, the mastering guy, and you're buying his time in a room that this is much more like a laboratory than wherever it is you're mixing.
Yeah, no kidding.
For sure. So we're here to solve the problems that you may or may not even be aware of.
Yeah.
And if in trying to solve a problem, I come up a little short on what you had hoped might come out of the mastering. It may need you, I mean, you need to submit a different mix.
Yeah, right.
So we can get what you want.
How often
me.
Does that happen where you say, hey, you're better off if you go
just
back
before
and
you call, came in here today, mm-hmm. I was on the phone to a client who I've mixed, I've mastered five or six projects with him in the last year or two. And I've never heard his mixes sound like this. I called him to say, did you get different speakers? Or you mix this one at a different place? He didn't mix it.
Okay. Yeah.
So I was calling him to raise my hand. Look, before I waste my time and your money, because you're paying by the hour.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we actually always like, and I would recommend, one thing your question is that people schedule a drive-through at your favorite mastering place before you're finished mixing. In fact, probably do one or two mixes and come by. We'll give you a half hour or something.
Yeah.
You know, and then listen, and we'll talk about what you hope. And can you really get that from this? And quite often, you know, you'll say, does this sound like this at your place?
Yeah.
No. Well, what's the difference? Well, I'm hearing way more bass or way little, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, sure.
What I'm saying?
Yeah,
no. Quite often there'll be surprises, and it's best if you can see what you're missing early in the game so you can do something about it and not bring in mixes that each one has, you know, has a major issue. Then, you know, we have less to do. It'll save you money, and the patient will come out in much better shape.
Yeah, much better product. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that someone either imparted to you or you learned along your career?
Business advice?
Business advice. Advice about the music business.
Well, I don't know why this jumped to my mind, but the first thing that did jump to my mind when you asked that is to always bust yourself before others bust you.
That's great.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's not only if you make a mistake, but if you have reservations or you're not confident that you have the right tool for the job or you're in the right room. Let's say back when I was a mixer that I don't know if this is the right room to be doing this. Or it's best to share those things honestly and up front right now when there's still an opportunity, and nobody's going to hang you for it.
Yeah.
If you try to sweep stuff under the rug or try to be Mr. Nice Guy and try to deal with a situation you knew right away was a recipe for a disaster, and you try to be Mr. Nice Guy, rarely works. And that took me a long time to look, you're not being a jerk, you're being a responsible guy.
Yeah.
To raise your hand and say either I'm not your guy or this studio isn't, or you know, whatever.
We've all been there where, you know, it takes a while to learn because it's human nature to just hold back and see what would happen. But and I guess as you get confidence in your career as you go along, it's a little easier.
I'm not a confrontational person by nature, but there are times when you have to learn that, you know, you have to step up and man up and
best for everybody.
Yeah, and including yourself, probably most importantly yourself.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Pete. This is great.
My very great pleasure.
Yeah. To find out more about Pete, go to the link that's at the bottom of the page, and that'll take you to Universal Mastering Studios, and you can look under the Engineers tab, or else you can just do a search for Pete Dell, that's D-O-E-L-L, or Universal Mastering Studios, and you'll come up with lots of information and lots of background on Pete. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put this show together. Thank you kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.